Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, June 8, 2017, during a live Courthouse Steps teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's teleforum conference call, as today we discuss the Esquivel-Santana versus Sessions case. I'm Dean Reuter, General Counsel and Vice President, Director of Practice Groups here at the Federal Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome return guest to Teleforum Conference Call today, Vikrant P. Reddy. He's a senior fellow at the Charles Koch Institute. He's going to walk us through the case with some background and then get us up to date on the case with opening remarks of about 15 to 20 minutes, after which we'll be turning to the audience for questions, so please do be thinking of those questions for when we get to that part of the program. With that, Vikrant Reddy, the floor is yours.
Thanks so much, Dean. I really appreciate it. I want to say thanks to the Federal Society for inviting me to do this. And I also want to give a special thanks to John Malcolm and my fellow members of the Executive Committee of the Criminal Law Practice Group. I don't know how many are on the call today, but they provide a terrific forum where we can discuss really thoughtful and interesting issues like the ones we're going to talk about today. And I really value the terrific work that the folks on that executive committee do. So let's talk a little bit about Esquivel-Quintana versus Sessions. This is a case that came down just last week. And today's teleform is going to be a little bit unusual because instead of talking a lot about what the Supreme Court did in this case, I'm actually going to spend a little bit more time talking about what the court did not do, because for the people who are really interested in matters of criminal law and even actually administrative law, the interesting story in Esquivel-Quintana is actually what didn't happen. But I'm going to start with the facts, and those are pretty straightforward. Under the Immigration and National Security Act, that's 8 U.S.C. section 1227, an alien can be deported from the United States upon, quote, conviction of an aggravated felony. Now, our law provides, or federal law provides, a list of things that can constitute an aggravated felony, and one of those things is sexual abuse of a minor. Now, the federal law does not specifically define sexual abuse of a minor, and that makes things a little bit complicated because minor, an age of consent, is different depending on what state you're in. I come from the state of Texas, and in my state, the age of consent is 17. Dean, you're on the call. You come from the state of Maryland. In that state, the age of consent is 16. Justice Gorsuch, who actually did not take part in this case, comes from the state of Colorado. There, the age of consent is 15. Barack Obama comes from Hawaii. The age of consent there is 14. Things get really, really different. There is a vast array of different ages that the age of consent is set at, depending on what state the conduct takes place in. Mr. Esquivel-Quintana's conduct took place in California. He is a lawful permanent resident of California. He moved there when he was in the year 2000, excuse me. He's originally and still is a Mexican citizen. In California, the age of consent is 18 years. When he was 20 years old, he had consensual sex with his 16-year-old girlfriend. This all happened in 2009. So in California, because the girl was 16 and he was 20, and California's age of consent is 18, that behavior constituted statutory rape. It is unlawful sexual intercourse with a minor who is more than 3 years younger than the perpetrator. That's California law. And he pleaded no contest to this offense under California law. So now it went to the Department of Homeland Security, which under the federal act that I cited before, was in a position to deport him back to Mexico because he had committed sexual abuse of a minor, and that was, under the federal statute, an aggravated felony. The Board of Immigration Appeals agreed with the decision of the Department of Homeland Security, and the case then went to the Sixth Circuit, which denied his appeal, but there was a dissent from the denial, and that dissent, which is probably interesting to Federal Society members, came from Judge Jeff Sutton. He's a good friend of the Federal Society, and I want to come back to Judge Sutton's dissent momentarily because it's really at the heart of what is the intellectual issue here. The decision from the Board of Immigration Appeals is what really kind of made this case interesting to a lot of people. The lower courts essentially sided with the board, saying, well, let's take a look at the problem here. We've got a statute that has some ambiguous and ill-defined language. You could reasonably interpret the language either way. In cases like that, what you do is you defer to the judgment of the agency or the board in question, because that's what we do under Chevron. And of course, Chevron doesn't need any introduction to the people on this call. This is the 1984 case, which holds that that you have to defer to agency and board interpretations of statutes. Now, Chevron may or may not be a wise precedent. There's a very vigorous national conversation happening about this right now, and the Federal Society has taken part in it. But I think it's pretty obvious that it poses a difficult problem when you are looking at the criminal law sphere, because what you have with the criminal law is courts deferring on interpretations of language in statutes that affect whether or not people can be incarcerated, whether or not they can be deported, like the man in this case, really whether or not they can even be executed. It's the most extraordinary power, domestic power, that government has, the power to enforce criminal law. And the idea that it would be delegated out under Chevron to administrative agencies is extremely problematic. It's troubling enough in the civil sphere, but in the criminal sphere, it can be very, very dangerous, because the people involved in making the decisions are ultimately unelected bureaucrats. And I don't mean bureaucrat in the kind of dismissive or derogatory way that it can be said sometimes. I just literally mean that these are people who do not have direct accountability via elections. And it's very dangerous to delegate such an extraordinary power to people who don't have that kind of accountability. So this was the question that came before the court, and the government made the argument that, well, Chevron is Chevron, and you have an ambiguous statute here, you're going to have to defer to the board's interpretation. Mr. Esquivel-Quintana made a different argument. He said, no, I mean, this is a criminal statute. What you would do in a case like this, where you've got ambiguous language that could go either way, is you would just apply the rule of lenity. And the rule of lenity is the interpretive doctrine that says whenever you've got ambiguous language that could go either direction reasonably, you defer in favor of the defendant. This is a really important protection for individual rights. The idea is that it forces, from the get-go, legislatures to be very precise and very careful with their drafting of criminal statutes. And Mr. Esquivel-Quintana made the rule of lenity argument. The government made the Chevron argument. So the court decided to do either, actually. They ducked the question. The decision was 8-0, and the court sort of went a different direction. They said, you know, we need a generic definition under federal law of what the age of consent is, because we've got all of these different ages of consent in different states, and it can't possibly be the case that the federal law is just situation specific and depends on what state the conduct took place in. Was it in Georgia? Was it in California? Was it in Maryland? Was it in Colorado or Hawaii or Texas? It can't work that way. We've got to figure out what the generic definition is. So the court turned to a dictionary. They went to the Dictionary of Modern Legal Usage at the time that the relevant immigration statute was passed, and they found that it defined age of consent as 16. The government had a problem with that, and they, in their brief, they went a different direction. They went to Black's Law Dictionary, and they said, well, in this dictionary, the age of consent is, the generic age of consent would be 18. The court didn't like that argument because the court saw it. They were actually, the government was using age of majority rather than age of consent. Age of majority is a little bit different. That's you know, the age that you are able to enter into contracts and things of that sort. Age of consent is different. And in fact, they even argue that under in Black's Law Dictionary, in addition to the Dictionary of Modern Legal Usage, the age of consent is more appropriately set at 16. That is the generic age of consent for the purposes of federal law. So because they were able to decide the question that way, they didn't really need to get into this question of Chevron deference versus rule of lenity. And deciding the case that way was a pretty obvious call to all the members of the court. The decision went 8-0. Justice Gorsuch did not take part in the case. He wasn't there in time. And so the case was decided relatively easily, but in a sense it kind of ended with a whimper rather than with a bang for people who have criminal practices and people who are interested in administrative law questions, because a lot of folks were really hoping that an answer would come forward on this question of the scope of Chevron deference. And it's become a very important part of the overall critique of Chevron that has been made by a number of very prominent people, Philip Pomberger probably most prominently, and a lot of the problems that we have with Chevron and Chevron deference, and the way that it has empowered in a lot of counterproductive ways the administrative state here in the United States. So I said I would go back to Judge Sutton and his comments in his original dissent in this case, because I think they're really important, and they're at the heart of what is intellectually interesting here. I'm going to read them to all of you, this one paragraph that stands out to me. He wrote that Chevron has no role to play in construing criminal statutes. In 227 years and counting, the federal courts have never presumed that when an ambiguity arises in a criminal statute, the congressional silence signals that Congress wants an executive branch agency to fill the gap. For all the theories of Chevron that have filled the U.S. reports, that filled the Federal Reporter, to say nothing of the law journals, the idea that Chevron is a tool for construing criminal statutes has yet to make an appearance. That's because criminal statutes are for courts, not for the government to construe. So that's where we're left here. Esquivel-Quintana was an interesting case, but at the end of the day, it didn't get to the question that most interests people who are scholars of Chevron administrative law and of criminal law, and we're just kind of left waiting to see if a case like that will come up anytime soon. I think that eventually the court is going to have to take on this this question of to what extent Chevron applies to our interpretation of criminal statutes. I don't know where that case is. Maybe there's something percolating in the lower courts as we speak, but that's where we are. That's the case, Dean.
Thank you so much, Vikrant Reddy. We're going to open the floor to questions in now, and I understand we've had some technical difficulties on the call, so I apologize to folks if they've had trouble getting into the call, and I'm hoping that our floor request mode will work here. But in a moment, you should all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for our guest, push the star button and then the pound button. So once again, with apologies for the technical difficulties, if you could push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone to indicate you have a question, we'll roll through the questions in the next 45 minutes or so. Before we turn to our first question, let me make an announcement about our upcoming schedule. Tomorrow at 1 p.m. is our next scheduled teleforum conference call. It's on national security reform, focused in particular on the office on ODNI. That's tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern Time at this same number. Today, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button. Let me get things started. You mentioned that they ducked the Chevron question, went with just sort of a straight statutory interpretation question. Two things are of interest to me, so maybe this is a two-part question. First, I find it interesting that all eight justices are looking to the dictionary to interpret a statute. Does that happen often, You know, it sort of reminds me of the Heller case where everybody's looking to original meaning, but here in a statute, it's, you know, dictionary meaning to the exclusion, I suppose, of legislative history. You didn't mention legislative history. So that's the first question. The second question I'll ask in a moment if nobody else rings in, but why don't you start with that one if you could?
Yeah, I don't have a good answer other than to say that I was just as taken by that as you were, and I also thought of Heller. I started asking myself, how often have I seen this kind of thing happen? There really was not any deep discussion of legislative history. It was a comparison of these dictionaries, actually. And I did wonder to what degree the court just really did not want to get into the Chevron question. It's become very controversial. It was a kind of an interesting thing to see it take prominence during the Gorsuch hearings, because it is believed that Justice Gorsuch has some views on Chevron. And people are curious about how the court is going to approach it. I've been wondering whether what ultimately happens with Chevron, and I don't know, there are some administrative scholars here who know better than me, if what will ultimately happen with it is that the court kind of piece by piece chips away at it without ever ultimately overturning it, sort of like the kind of thing that happens in the incorporation doctrine, where it's just sort of a piece by piece, case by case, building up. You know, what you could do with something like that is you could start finding tiny little ways in which Chevron is still good law, but it doesn't apply. It doesn't apply here, it doesn't apply here, it doesn't apply here. And something like this, deference to agencies and their interpretation of criminal statutes would be an excellent little way to just chip away.
Yeah, that is a nice sort of neat, clean category you can set off to the side. And that sort of gives me a segue to my second question. Why didn't they do that? And maybe the question I was really out to ask, why did they take this case? It seems to me unlikely they took this case in order to dodge the Chevron issue. But I'd love to hear your insights on that. Did they take this case with a grander vision of revisiting Chevron, or maybe even a more limited vision? And then how did they end up not addressing that and going the statutory interpretation route instead?
Well, I wonder about the exact same thing. You know, normally we have plenty of examples of courts taking a case, looking like they're going to take on a challenging philosophical question, then sort of ducking that question. The one that comes to mind immediately is like the Pledge of Allegiance case, for example, where they sort of duck the question that interested everybody as a matter of law and philosophy to instead just, you know, go to standing. But when that happens, you'll frequently get some kind of a dissent or something from the justices who obviously wanted to take on the more difficult question. Here you didn't get that. It just went 8-0. And so I'm very curious about what their reasoning was behind taking the case in the first place, and I'm not able to speculate on that. I don't know.
Very good. Once again, if you have a question for our guest, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. It looks like we do have one question pending. Hopefully this system is working. Again, apologies for the complications with the phone today and some technical difficulties, but let's see if we can take our first question of the day.
I have a question that this may be something that's hidden in plain sight, but the immigration and nationalization legislation is actually civil, isn't it? Whereas the underlying reference are criminal. Oh, why couldn't a person simply say that Chevron does apply to what the BIA does and so on, because it's actually a civil proceeding along the lines of forgive me for putting it this way, taking a drug off the market? I know that human beings are involved here, so that's not a fair comparison. But why couldn't that approach be taken in response to Judge Sutton? And in addition, in today's extremely delicate world of immigration and questions of border security, maybe this is exactly where the court might want to present for a bright-line statutory rule, avoided ducking Chevron deference, and did what it thought was the humanitarian thing. Thank you.
Yeah, that's a fantastic question, actually, and it gives me the opportunity to clarify something. I should have been a little bit more clear about this point. You're right. It does have civil applications, but then it also has criminal applications, and that makes it complicated on yet another level, because it is, as Judge Sutton called it in his dissent, a hybrid statute. And he said it just can't be the case that this same statute, depending on whether or not we're going to apply it in a criminal way or a civil way, is subject to different types of deference and different sorts of judicial interpretive canons. He was uncomfortable with that.
Yeah,
and
that's
in fact,
fair point.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, I think I can find some language. I've got his original opinion in front of me. He wrote, an exception to Chevron for dual role statutes would not be, deference under that rule is categorically unavailable in multiple settings, agency interpretations of statutes that the agency is not charged with administering, agency. Well, I probably shouldn't go on reading all this. That could get a little bit tedious. But yeah, that is the bottom line, that it's a hybrid statute, and that complicates things quite a bit.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. That does, as I was saying, it looked like there was something perhaps hidden in plain sight. Now I see what it is. Thank you.
Yeah.
Our lines are wide open now. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone to indicate you have a question. While we're waiting to see if anybody else rings in, Vikrant, this case is interesting because the court provides sort of this nationwide common understanding of what had developed as differing standards that you cited in the beginning for consent. Are there other terms and laws, you know, that differ from one state to another, where you see either the federal, the executive branch or the legislative branch, the federal government or the courts supplying standardized definitions?
It's going to be hard for me to be really specific off the top of my head, but what I can tell you is that this kind of thing will come up very frequently in the criminal context, where in this case we were trying to figure out what constitutes an aggravated felony, and you know, under different states' statutes and common laws, there are really tiny differences between what constitutes burglary in one state or what constitutes sexual assault in one state, not the other. There are differences in the way all sorts of crimes are defined, and this kind of thing will come up very frequently. In fact, I want to say there was a case, I think the last case I did a teleforum on, Johnson versus United States, where they were, if I recall correctly, they were trying to determine whether or not possession of a sawed-off shotgun constituted a violent felony. This is possession as opposed to use. And it could be determined differently depending on where you were. And they needed to, this gentleman was, his conduct took place in Minnesota, but they needed to figure out what the federal standard was for application of the Armed Career Criminal Act. So this kind of thing does happen a lot. And these are interesting questions.
Well, let me make a final call for questions. If you have a question, now is the time to indicate so. And I do hope our system's working and there aren't people trying to ask questions and not able to get through, but at least one person did. Push the star button, then the pound button on your phone if you have a question. I don't see the final question. Vikrant Reddy, you want to take a minute or two to wrap up or express any final thoughts before we adjourn?
Just that, you know, it's a really interesting issue. These Chevron debates are becoming increasingly fascinating. I assume at the National Lawyers Convention this year, Chevron will come up. It's been coming up year after year now. And I'm interested in seeing what the future of Chevron is. It's going to affect a lot of people's practices in a very profound way. And I just want to say thanks to everybody for joining the call today. I know it is an extremely busy news day, so those of you who did call in are real Supreme Court junkies, and I appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Vikrant Reddy, for joining us. And I can assure, for those of you who haven't heard, that the convention this year, November 16th through the 18th, so mark your calendar, 16th through the 18th, and the theme of the convention is very likely to be administrative agencies in the regulatory state. No way we can cover that without discussing Chevron in a lot of detail. So thank you, Vikrant Reddy, for the chance to plug the convention as well. Thanks to the audience, too, for joining in, for dialing in, and for your questions. Reminder about our next scheduled telephone conference call tomorrow at 1 p.m., talking about national security. Until that next call, though, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.